I am your host, Antoine Medley. Join me here on the Force Pivot podcast as I, along with guests, explore how we ride this roller coaster called life, how we try to deal with the force pivots of life that we all face each and every day. No life is lived in a straight line, and learning how others deal can be therapy for us all. Listen, subscribe, and share our show with others. Let's go.
Hey, what's up, good people? It's Antoine Medley, the host and creator of the Force Pivot podcast. I want to welcome you guys to another awesome show, I hope, which I know it will be. I do that every single time I pull a new episode together. It's like, you know, I'm hoping it's going to be better than the next. And every single time it's better than the next. So I want to welcome you guys to this show. Hopefully, you know, this guest will definitely bring some enlightenment to you just about, you know, how he got to where he is today. You know, no life is living in a straight line. And I know for this brother, I'm pretty sure it's the same way. We all, you know, bounce here and bounce there, you know, and we find our way through this life. And, you know, I mean, I think that's something that every single person on this earth has in common. It doesn't matter how much money you have, how much money you don't have. This life is going to make you go left, right, backwards and forward. So, that's something that every human being, I think, has in common. And I think that, you know, when I thought about this show, The Force Pivot, you know, it's like back in March 2020, everything changed for every single person on this planet. You know, we all had to realize that life is so fragile, and that, you know, I'm not gonna say as small as a virus, but you know, none of us ever thought in a million years that this would happen to us, right? But again, this pandemic has forced every single life to change, and it's forced us all to pivot in some way, some for the better, some for the worse, you know. But the thing is, as long as we're here, as long as we have breath, as long as we're blessed to have the ability to do, we need to do. And, you know, that's how I live my life. It's, you know, as long as I have the ability, you know, I can't ask the Lord for anything else. Just give me that ability, and I'm going to do what I can do to make whatever happen. And so, you know, that's my goal with this show, is just to bring people on that have sort of, you know, worked their way through their life to make things happen, right? Again, you know, I live a life where I think about legacy all the time. You know, I mean, I don't live my life just to be here day to day. You know, I try to find things and find ways where I can help better the lives of other people, better the lives of my family, better the lives of my, you know, my daughters, my friends, anybody that I can touch and make their lives better. You know, that's my goal, right? So, but again, I don't want to talk too much, but this is our episode. Gosh, I think it's episode 16. You know, and we're holding strong, and hopefully we can keep this thing going. But I'm gonna go ahead and bring on our guests. This brother is a fraternity brother of mine. He's another good alpha man, which I've had a number of them on the show. The brother is a mover and a shaker. But even with this moving and shaking, what I've known from this brother probably over the last, I'm trying to think how long have I known him? I've probably known him close to 10 years. And this brother, he's one of the most humble brothers I know. You know, to be doing some pretty, pretty extravagant things, he's a real humble brother. But I'm going to bring on my frat brother DeLeon Gray. How you doing, man? How you doing?
I'm doing well. Living the dream, man. Living the dream.
I know that's right, man. I know that's right. So how are things been going with you, you know, today? You know, I mean, you know, we live life day by day. So how is today?
We do. today has been great. One of the good things that happened today, there was two victories from today. Okay. One, we brought my son in for his 2-month checkup to the doctor, and everything was, you know, really smooth there. You know, he's developing and progressing very well. And two, my wife and I, we were working through strategies in terms of how we wanted to build and, you know, really design things financially for our household. And although we did not sync up and agree in the flesh. We prayed about it, and we, you know what I'm saying, we got on the same page after prayer that this is the direction that we'll head, even if we don't necessarily agree on the direction, you know, we're going to have each other's back and proceed. And I think that was such a big win, because financial conversation can go, you know, many different ways. So I'm grateful for her for, you know, being there with me and being my rib and sticking in there in a discussion and really believing, you know, and something that I set forth. So that was a big win.
That's good, man. I mean, you sound like you're off to this marriage thing in the right way. You know, I'm almost 26 years in, man. You're doing good, bro.
Thank you. I appreciate it. You know, I appreciate the support that I'm getting from older people on my side, but also people who she's introduced into my life as well. So it's a blessing, man. I'm a blessed man to have her. I'm rich with her in my life.
Yeah, definitely. So, man, look, you know, my show, I bring on extraordinary people that are doing some extraordinary things. So, man, tell me. So I saw that you went to school University of Maryland, Baltimore College, right? Mm-hmm. So are you from the Maryland, D.C. area? Where are you from?
Yeah, so I went to University of Maryland, Baltimore County, affectionately known as UMBC. Born in Washington, D.C. originally. Mm-hmm. Went to elementary school on Howard University's campus. They used to have an elementary school there back in the day. It was called Gage Eckington. It was a D.C. public school, but it's right in the middle of, near the Howard University Hospital and Slow Hall. And it was in the middle of that. They turned it into a little park area now. Used my grandmother's address to go to that school because we lived in Southeast. She lived in Northwest. So you know how, you know, that goes.
Right.
After that, you know, we moved to Temple Hills, Maryland, which is in Prince George's County, right over the line from Southeast. So I went to middle school and high school in Temple Hills, Oxon Hill High School. Ran track there and ended up going to UMBC, running track there for my time there.
Okay, okay. So what did you major at UMBC?
Man, that is a blessing. I found this major on my first day. It was called Interdisciplinary Studies.
Okay.
And so the word interdisciplinary has become such a buzzword in recent years, but we really got a chance to grapple with what that meant for us in our lives. And we got a lot of quality attention because the major was not very popular. When people heard it, they might think general studies, right? Are you really majoring in anything and where you headed? But really, we really had to craft a roadmap for our future by pulling two or three different disciplines together to come up with something unique to us. And so bringing in mathematics, education, and psychology became the way that I fused things together for my career. And I ended up getting accepted from undergrad straight into a PhD program at Ohio State, or the Ohio State University. And that program was called Educational Psychology, so it was a perfect blend. But on the way through that program, I got my master's degree in Quantitative Research Evaluation and Measurement. So there were a number of things that make my path not exactly straight, but one thing that I'm grateful for was that foundation that UMBC provided, you know, through interdisciplinary studies to position me for my future.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's similar to me, man. I went to Virginia Tech, and I've got a BA in economics, and I've got a minor in statistics and math, you know, because I like those numbers, man. And I was a stat major for a year, but the stat school was so small that, you know, if I didn't, you know, I wasn't on their calendar, which would have put me in school for like another semester. So I was like, I got to change this. I got to get out of here. You know, so I changed my major just so I could get out.
But isn't it funny? I've been thinking about this lately. Isn't it funny how time is at the center of a lot of decisions that we make?
Man, time, yes, you are exactly right.
And, you know, it's not only us, it's the way others structure or try to govern or dictate our time and what happens within a time frame for us. Yeah. You know, because, I mean, it sounds like had certain courses been available, you know, at certain times of year, you know.
Things would have pivoted. I would have stayed on track or, you know, but you're right. That time structure made me pivot to do something else because I was like, okay, I've been here long enough. I got to get out of here, you know. And so you're right. You're right. I hadn't really thought about it like that, but I know, you know, time does a lot. Cause I know, I think, you know, the relationship I have with Cornel West and I talked to Dr. West one time about why he dresses the way he dresses, why he, you know, his whole decor, I mean, you know, his whole thing. And he was like, well, you know what, Brother Medley, he's like, you know, I don't have time to try to figure out what I'm going to wear. You know, I grab a black suit every day. I don't have time. You know, I got other things. I got better things to do with my time than worry about what I'm putting on. Yes. I grab these black shoes. I grab these black socks. I grab this white shirt. I grab this black suit and this black tie, and I'm out.
And which is a beautiful thing to be able to, you know, simplify life in that way. You know, and make a statement while you're doing it as well.
Exactly.
You know, on the flip side, I always think about, you know, catching myself when I say I don't have time for, because sometimes the thing that I don't have time for, it's like, why? Who made it that I didn't have time to do that thing? You know, and that's my number one wrestling point right now in my life, you know?
Right. Yeah, I feel you. I mean, and I'm with you because, you know, because we hear, you know, I mean, I'm gonna go right there. We hear with our fraternity in our chapter, right? Brothers like, I don't have time, you know, I don't have time to do this for the chapter. I don't have time to do that for the chapter, but you got time. You got an hour. Nobody's busy for 16 hours in a day. Nobody. If you got an hour to sit and watch television, you got an hour to do something that you could do something else. You know, I mean, how much TV do we watch? How much, you know, whatever we do, you know, you have time. People have time to do the things that are important to them. So, you know, it is what it is.
And runway is important too. That's the one of the things that I think about too. It's like, okay, well, you know, do you need more runway? And if you need more runway, you know, say that and take it, you know, and, you know, because most of the times where I've gotten into jams in my life or felt like I didn't have enough time is because I didn't give myself enough runway to execute. So by giving ourselves more time, you know, and just negotiating what the actual endpoint or deadline is, it makes it more reasonable for us to, you know, figure that out. But I don't know, deadlines, some deadlines are negotiable, right, which you can push out. But other times, you know, the starting point, you know, is the ultimate thing that you can negotiate, right? You know, right. So you can, if you move the starting point up, that for sure gives you enough runway to take off.
Yeah, you know? And if you start when you say you're going to start, you know, then you give yourself even more time. More people are like, I got to do this. I'm going to start it, but you might start it 2 days later and you missed 2 days where you could have gotten a ton of work done. Okay. I stress that to my kids all the time. It's like, you know, you don't ever come and tell me you didn't have time when I saw you in your room watching Netflix. You had time, you know? So, well, man, look, how was your experience at the Ohio State University?
You know, can I talk about UMBC really quickly?
Yeah, go ahead.
Very diverse school, a lot of talented undergraduates there. The president of the school is frat. Well, he was Dr. Freeman Hrabowski. He would walk through the school. I'm talking about, like, I mean, I'd be in the commons doing a lot of nothing, wasting time, right? Right. He would walk past the commons, and it was common for you to know who he was and to see him. Oh, that's the, you know, college president. It's just regular, right? And, you know, there was a time where I was doing mostly programming for our fraternity. I was the president of the chapter, captain of the track team. And I would come up to him and I would hand him a flyer like, hey, Doc, you got to come to our event. He'd be like, what's your GPA? And that time I was like, oh, man, are you serious? Right? But it was really meaningful that he did that to us because he didn't, you know, lower the bar at all, you know. And he would say, come see me. And so in my young mind, I'm like, he's not supporting my program. So why am I going to deal with him? Right. But over time, I'm like, you know what? He has a whole university run. And he told me that I can come sit down with him. How valuable is his time? Right.
And he's offering it to you.
Right. So I go in. I mean, we have really, really good conversations in there. Non-political conversations. He is laying it all out in the realest way possible for me. Laying it out in a real way. Even showing me stuff like pictures when he was online. I mean, online in a whatever that would mean, you know. But I mean, I saw pictures of him from back in the day, which humanized the experience for me. I'm like, okay. You know, this not only is this person touchable in the sense that you can see him and speak to him, you know, and he knows your face, but he's now also touchable because, you know, we have been in similar quarters. I can relate to him on that. I saw a picture of him when he was in college.
Right. You know? Right.
But that set me up well, but it also kind of spoiled me a little bit because I go to The Ohio State University. Academically, you know, I'm, you know, prepared as you can be for the experience. There's less diversity there at the university. So I really felt like on the first day when I stepped foot on campus and, you know, classes got out at a certain time all across campus, it was so white, you know, I felt like it was snowing at me on campus. I called my mom like, yo, I mean, I don't know how this is going
to
go.
This young man that went to elementary school on Howard's campus.
Right.
Who's lived in, went to college in Baltimore. You know, you in Chocolate City, man. And now you're in Columbus, Ohio.
I'm like, oh, this is America. this is what it's like. Right. You know, but, you know, UMBC gave me a very strong foundation that really set me up for that experience. And I felt like, I mean, I could go toe-to-toe, you know, with folks academically, which, you know, and I understood that, which relates to my research on belonging a little bit. Something that scholars don't really talk about is belonging is also demanded, you know? And so my experience wasn't all rough, but, you know, I mean, me first perceiving that I deserve to be here, you know, right?
Right.
Kind of, you know, guided me even through, you know, kind of, you know, when demographically, you know, things just didn't look like, you know, my tribe, you know, but I connected with a great advisor there. He did all kinds of things for me that were not, that he couldn't do for everybody else. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing that he did is he became an administrator at the university. So now he has two offices. So what does he do? He gives me the keys to one of his offices. Hey, look, you know, you can spend time in here. Got the Lazy Boy, got all my books. Here's the password to my computer. You know, just, you know, hang out as much as you want. But what it did was it took me back to UMBC. I had a mentor there, Dr. Carissa Chia. She did the same thing. I was, you know, the assistant dean of pledges for a line. That semester, I got a 1.3 GPA. 1.3. She's like, hey, you know, just let me holler at you real quick.
What are you doing?
Past that, she was like, hey, look, guess what, fam? I got to kick you out of my lab. You know? I'm like, why? You know, she's like, don't play these games. You know, you know what it is. You have to go. And I'm like, but I don't think it's a regular thing. I think this is just one blip. She's like, this is a pretty big blip. She said, how am I going to sell you to graduate schools?
Right.
I said, she said, you're taking up space. I said, trust me, I'm not, you know, I begged her to stay. She said, you know what? You can stay if you get a 4.0. I'm like, are you kidding? I got a 1.3. She said, you know what? You're already defeated. You can go. I'm like, no. Okay, cool. Let me do it. I can go. She gave me the keys to her lab, the keys to the psychology building, the passwords to all of her computers and alarm codes to her lab, but also the keys to her car to go out and collect data. And she said, you have no excuse. And so I'm like, if this Asian woman can do this for me as a black man, what could I do if I was on the other side of the desk, right?
Right.
So, so when the same thing is happening to me at Ohio State, more or less, I'm like, okay, I know what to do. You know, I've been here before. It was late nights. I stayed up all night trying to like get my act together. Now I'm starting from a blank state, or even like I would say favor, you know, where my advisor Eric Anderman is looking out for me in this way. And I'm like, well, I mean, this is a major, I know how that accelerated my path in undergrad. Same thing. I already know what I'm here for, you know, so I'm on assignment. Let me go ahead and just, you know, lock in, you know.
So it sounds like you've run across some people in your life that have just, they've sort of forced you to pivot by challenging you to be what they saw in you.
Right. Man, you know, yeah, they were like, this isn't enough, but I see what you're working with. What you put out so far is not enough, you know, and I'm going to double down, you know, on what I see, you know, so that you can, and you arise, you know, you arise.
It's like they didn't cut any corners, right? They didn't baby you. You know, I had an advisor like that when I was at Virginia Tech. I'm up there, you know, I'm not going to see her. And she was a sister, you know, and I'm not going to see her. And she's like calling my room looking for me. You know, I'm just taking class. I'm just doing whatever I want to do. I'm barely getting by because I'm just wasting time, wasting space. And she did call me, and I talked to her on the phone one day. And she's like, Antoine, she's like, you come see me tomorrow at 1 o'clock. She said, if you don't, I'm going to show up at Pritchard Hall to get you. And I was like, okay, I don't want this black woman coming to get me, you know? So I go to her desk, I go to her office, and I think she may have been one of the only black advisors. And so I'm sitting in there, and she was like, follow me. And she gets up and walks out of her office. We walk down the stairs out the front of we were sitting in front of the Burris Hall. I remember so well. So she's called me all the way outside because I think she really wanted to tell me what she wanted to tell me. And she sat down with me, and then she got up and stood in front of me. And then her friend came, this sister named Angela. I cannot remember her name, but she sat down beside me. So I got one sitting beside me, and they're both Deltas, I think, and one standing in front of me. And she's like, why are you being so trifling? I had never been called trifling in my life. She called me trifling. She said, you know, these white folks don't want you up here no way. And you up here just doing whatever you want to do. Not going to class, and that, man, they lit into me, man. And I was sitting there, Brother Gray, like I was punch drunk. And it was like, that's all it took. That's all it took. They just lit into me, and they were like, look, so before every semester, you know, you need to get in here to see me at least twice during the semester, and you don't sign up for a single class till you come see me.
Wow.
That was all I needed, man.
Yeah, that is huge. I want to double click on that story by sharing a story of someone that I know. I'll leave her identity semi-anonymous and say that she went to UMBC. She was a little ahead of me. Her name was Danielle. Danielle was super sharp. She was a math whiz. And, you know, she was the TA at, like, during undergrad, she was TAing for Calc 2, right? I'm like, okay, well, but she was also on the track team. So, I mean, I'm paying attention, but I'm also, you know, just, you know, enjoying life and enjoying undergrad. I'm like, my parents didn't go to college, so I'm going to absorb everything, you know, right? That was my mindset, right?
Right.
But she goes and tells the coach of our track team, she said, hey, look, the Leon hasn't been coming to class. I'm like, so he pulls up on me, and he's giving me the energy. And I'm like, this is that same semester, but this is before I got called out by my psychology professor. And so I'm like, I gotta say something to her, right? You know, I have to. I'm like, why would you say that to coach? She's like, where I'm from, that's called looking out. I'm like, well, that's called snitching. I don't really appreciate it, right? So fast forward, she just stops talking to me altogether. She doesn't even acknowledge me, does nothing. You know, for the rest of her time at UMBC before she graduates, she's done with me. And so one of my friends went and talked to her and said, why aren't you talking to DeLeon? She said, you know, if DeLeon put half of his energy that he puts into being an alpha into his books, he would be a bad dude. But because he doesn't see the whole picture, you know, I just can't rock with that because this is a waste of potential. I just can't, you know. And so, yeah, there's been a lot of people who have seen things, and I'm grateful for people who see things in you that at the time you lack perspective. It's not that you don't believe in yourself, but sometimes you just lack perspective, you know?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times, like you just said, it just takes other people to, because sometimes it's harder for people to shift on their own. Right. It's really hard sometimes. But if you've got somebody who's willing to, you know, kick you in your butt, you know, and you know they're not trying to do it out of malice or to hurt you, you know, I mean, you can't help but open your eyes to it, you know, to a degree. You have to.
And related to that, too, I just want to say parents put so much pressure on their children to graduate in 4 years. I didn't graduate in 4 years. I wasn't on pace to do that.
Me either. I was on a 5-year program.
Same. And something that's relevant to that, though, is if I would have like just tried to push to graduate in 4, because I got to get out in 4, because that's what I'm told. I would have got out, not really had a plan, and just had to like meander for a while to kind of figure it out. I knew I wanted to be a teacher first, and then I wanted to go back to grad school for psychology, but I didn't know what type. But, you know, as I got deeper into research, and I was doing student teaching, but they were placing me in schools that weren't exactly the type of schools that I went to. I didn't feel prepared to go back to the schools that I was from, because I wasn't getting any training on how to do that, right? So, but I was getting a lot of additional training from my psychology professor. So one pivot in my journey was going from, you know, being, you know, a teacher at the K-12 level first to just saying, you know what, I'm going to accelerate and go straight to grad school and teach at the university, you know, because that's where my guidance is and that's who's giving me the green light right now. And I'm just very, you know, fortunate for the pivots that have happened in my life. But also I just wanted to, you know, just acknowledge that those pivots, you know, very much did occur.
So you're at Ohio State, you're working on your PhD, and so you wrap that up. So where do you land after that?
Before I mentioned that, I wanted to connect the dots to say that I graduated in 5 years from UMBC, right? But my graduate program is such that, you know, I'm accepted straight into the PhD program because I took that extra year, but I also like got really, really deep and committed to research. So much so that Ohio State gave me a full scholarship, fellowship, you know, assistantship situation for my PhD straight from undergrad.
Wow.
So tuition, health insurance, and stipend were all covered for me to get my PhD, right? It's a huge blessing for somebody who did not have the perfect GPA, up and down, like one of those heart things, you know. And so getting in, the person who got me in was Bruce Tuckman. He talked on the phone with me like most days during my senior year. He was like, I know exactly where this guy's head is at. I'm advocating for him at the university. He wrote me an internal recommendation for a university fellowship. Got me into the university. You know, I mean, you know, got my master's on the way, as I mentioned earlier. But, you know, when I got on in 5 years, although I graduated undergrad in five, I got my PhD and master's combined in five. So I get a job at NC State. You know, there was a couple of other schools that were looking, but Raleigh-Durham was clearly the best move. I get a job at NC State, and I start my job as a professor at the age of 27.
Wow.
So I get down here, and I'm connecting with students in schools, trying to get my research off the ground and really just connect and do outreach work. They're like, wait, you know, time out before you even go further. I thought professors were old. And I'm like, many of them are. They end up being old, but, you know, they're like, look, you know, how did you get here? And I'm like, wow, my journey from, like, you know, acting out and just doing all kinds of things in undergrad, but having the right supports around me and also recognizing, like, okay, this is a lane. Let me, you know, get in this lane and move forward. The pivots that I made career-wise and thinking about what was the right path for me, and also like heeding advice for those around me, it kind of added up to the point where I was a faculty member. And at the time that I started at NC State, I don't know of any faculty members that were younger than me at that point. You know, there's probably, you know, some point in time where there's a professor who's younger than 27, but it's not typical, but it definitely can happen.
So did you have a connection to NC State, or was this just they sought you out? Did you seek them? What was it?
Yeah, I want to acknowledge someone who I did know at NC State, but I wouldn't call it an in. Her name was Heather Davis, and she used to be a professor at OSU before moving to NC State. And so I knew of her. I did have a conversation, but it's very common to have conversations about the job market with people if they have a job opening at the university before you apply. You know, it's not, you know, uncommon to do that. So I did know her, but it was pretty cold. She definitely made me earn it, you know. And she was not, to my knowledge, even on the search committee for the position. So yeah, it was kind of cold, but I think the beauty of OSU and also UMBC and where, like, the dots all connect in hindsight, right? Let me say that first.
They always do when you take time to really sit back and look at it.
I saw the NC State job post come out, and they said, we are looking for an educational psychologist who also can teach quantitative methods. I said, oh, that's my job. You know, there was no question in my mind. I'm like, that's me. Like, who else is going to do this job? But, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, just walking in confidence, but also bringing together everything that was connected in my interdisciplinary studies major in undergrad, you know, all the pieces just lined up perfectly. And the Raleigh-Durham area had Black people, you know, there was a professor there to give me a hug on my interview, you know, after I interviewed and I was closing out. And I was like, you know what? I can rock with this. Let's go. You know, but there were offers from Clemson University on the table. And another offer from Emory University reached out to me for an interview, but there was somebody who graduated at the same time as me who was also already down there, and she was interviewing for the same position. So my advisor was like, don't play those games. You already know that you like NC State, Raleigh-Durham. Let's not do that. You know, let's go where you're supposed to go, and don't put a sour taste in anybody as well. Yeah.
Wow, man. I mean, so you know, you've been doing work with kids ever since I've known you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, working with you work with students on campus, but most of the work that I'm familiar with you about is working with kids. You know, working with young people, trying to motivate them, advocating for them. So what? Tell the audience a little bit about your Black and Belonging and how, you know, maybe through that, how we can help young people, you know, pivot, you know, learn to pivot and adjust, you know, through this life, man. You know, because I think if kids, I often think if kids were more flexible to dealing with the ups and downs, you know, sort of like a resilience, right? You know, if kids are more resilient, they can deal with the yeses and nos a lot better than most. You know, or what could schools do to help kids, you know, maybe learn those skills, or is that their place?
There's so much in what you said just now. I have so many ideas flooding in my brain. So first, let's just start with Black and Belonging and what is it. So we collaborate primarily with students in predominantly Black schools to disrupt structural aspects of schooling that leave students vulnerable to anxieties about belonging. So that could look like workshops. That could look like planning different belonging initiatives, you know, helping them assess, you know, students' belonging experiences. But everything is custom built, you know, particularly our youth voice initiatives that we do with young people directly. And we have an amazing team, not only of, you know, folks who have taught previously in schools, but also young people who are currently like going through schools. We want to make sure that we credential them so that they're positioned to get into college. If you work with a college professor before on research and you've led a research project or you've done an initiative at your school or even have spoken at a university already, you know, about your work, why shouldn't they offer you the full ride? Particularly if you got the 4.0, particularly if you are a student athlete, but even if you're not, you know, haven't you demonstrated that you embody the values that the university says that they're about? And this especially is becoming more and more true every day because so many different institutions and companies are adopting the language of belonging, you know. And so in order to really unpack what that really means, my young people that I work with, they can tell you exactly what it means to them. And they've done research on their topic to articulate it well, you know, with research evidence. So how did I get to this point? There's a pivot story here. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing research for a while when I was in grad school in Bologna. I graduated in 2012 from grad school. But one of my dissertation papers that I was writing was on this idea of belonging. I submitted to this top tier journal of mine. But then I got rejected from that journal. But then in 2015, I was like, you know what? The paper wasn't trash. I do think it was missing something though, right? It was missing perspective. And then after that, there's a lot that was unfolding in society. I mean, Trayvon Martin being killed was one of the biggest things that I needed guidance thinking through. I actually protested and demonstrated quite a bit. And I had to be pulled up by my college president from UMBC, who gave me a call after I got arrested for protesting. And he was like, "What in the world are you doing?" He said, "You're down there on assignment. It's not that you can't demonstrate with your body, but there's some things that you're uniquely positioned to do as a professor." But at the time, I didn't really recognize the power of being a faculty member because I was just on the hamster wheel trying to get tenure. And it just, I wasn't doing work that was at the level of impact that I felt like I had in me. And so I was like, well, what am I supposed to be doing? What am I supposed to be talking about? Right. And so I was like, you know what? I don't need to be talking about everybody's belonging. I know this is important for motivation, but what is important for the world to know about Black students and their belonging? So I wrote this paper called Black and Belonging at School. And it was written in the top journal in my field, Educational Psychologist. And there was the main point that was raised in our article, which is when we think about belonging, I define it as acceptance, respect, inclusion, and support. However, when a lot of people think about belonging, they think about relationships first. And it's important for students to have relationships. And it's not that we want to take that for granted, but the story doesn't stop there. That's the foundation. There's a lot that can be built on top of that. That's one type of opportunity structure. And I want people to think about belonging as an opportunity structure. The reason why is because if you think about it as opportunities, then you can ask yourself, what can I do to provide students with opportunities to feel like they belong in school? So an interpersonal opportunity structure is where we start. But we also know that students benefit from what we call instructional opportunity structures, which, you know, for Black students are, you know, opportunities to connect with my ancestral heritage and or community. But on top of that, there's institutional opportunity structures where Black students get to practice being citizens with rights. If you understand your rights and you understand what is owed to you, then you navigate the world differently. How do we expect for students to embrace their true roles and be empowered in society if they don't practice that in school? So we have the capacity and the opportunity to really change the world from the inside out or replicate societal injustices through what we do in schools. And so, you know, but opportunity places the onus on the environment and not the person to change. And I think a lot of what we do when, you know, Black people get into spaces, both in school and in society, we're forced to shift and assimilate to the values of the larger collective when we're getting signals that this environment isn't built for us. And it brings about a level of dissonance and also, you know, coping that we need to do. And some of the coping that we might do is passive, you know, while doing what we have to do to navigate the system. And other times it's active, which is bucking the system. So when we see students disengaged at school, you know, we might ask ourselves, does this student feel like this environment is built for them? You know, and so there's so much in educators' power that they can do to make students feel like they belong at school. But we also need to understand that belonging, although it's a universal human need, which is, you know, in my mind, evidenced by the fact that people experience cognitive decrements, you know, wellness concerns, they're not unable to perform as well academically when they don't perceive a sense of belonging. We also have to understand that belonging can be uniquely expressed culturally. And there are specific ways where Black students may be especially vulnerable to anxieties about belonging because of the way schools are structured. There's nothing wrong with a Black student having a healthy skepticism about society and what society thinks about them and wondering when they walk into place, as we do when we walk in the workplace, okay, what's this environment really like? You know, who's really here? Who can I really turn to? You know, It doesn't just start when you're at work. It doesn't start when you're in college. It can start much earlier because our environments force us to keep our antennas up. So, yeah.
I mean, the way I think about it, what you're saying is that, I mean, I know for young people, you know, they spend a ton of time in school. Mm-hmm. And so in a lot of cases, you know, they don't feel like they belong out here in society. You know, if they watch the news enough, you know, they get bombarded where they don't feel that they belong. And then they get into this space where they, you know, we expect them to feel safe and nurtured, you know, that they don't get that there. or that when they get to the, you know, they get to a certain space, you know, where they don't feel that that's there. It's just, it's kind of like, what do I do? I'm in a place where I'm supposed to feel nurtured and to learn and to be, you know, encouraged and built up. And I don't get that, but then I'm back out here in society, you know, and I'm not getting it there either. Right. It's like, you know, in some cases, you know, prayerfully, in some cases, you know, I mean, which is sad that the kids, the only place they get that is at home, you know, but they can't, you can't stay at home. Right. You can't stay at home. You got to come out here in society. You got to go to school. So it's like you're leaving a nurturing environment, but you're getting beat down the time you leave the house, you know, in society, all like you said, all day in school, they're potentially getting, you know, beat down and they're not feeling like they belong to anything. And then they go back home. It's like, you know, a kid is just, they're just weather beaten. By the world, you know, it's like the time you walk out the front door, it's like, you know, you're caught in the hurricane and you pray that you can get back home, you know. I mean, you know, even with my girls in school, and then, you know, I mean, I'll, you know, even though, you know, I kept my eyes on the ball all the time with their education, you know, to where, you know, I'm at the school, they know me, I'm at the parent teacher meetings, you know. So that, you know, okay, well, you know, this Black man is involved in their child's life, in his child's life. So, you know, you can't, if I put that personal relationship with that teacher, you know, because, you know, in elementary school, they're mostly in with one teacher, you know, I'm letting you know that, that I'm watching, that I'm there, that I'm engaged, that if I have to come here and help them, you know, help them belong, you know, I'm willing to do that.
Yeah, so I had a study that I most recently published. It came out last week, actually, in this journal called Urban Education. And it built on this idea of opportunities to belong. So that framework, the Black Belonging paper, introduced my opportunities to belong, you know, framework. And this journal introduced a measure that I created to assess opportunities to belong. But I did it in a way that was more dynamic. So my team, we assess belonging experiences of students in each of their four academic subjects that are their core subjects: math, science, English, language arts, and social studies. But we also assessed the extent to which they were engaged in those subjects. We provided the reporting opportunities in English and in Spanish. We built the surveys with practicing educators. So the items were based on what they, you know, felt were the most practical belonging items. But we also got feedback from students before we did the survey so that we knew that students were able to interpret the items. And so all of this is important because we're building a larger case beyond this one study for like belonging to be measured regularly and assessed in a way, in ways that teachers can like adaptively respond to them. But here's what we found in our study. We found that the measure was cognitively valid, but we also found that there was a more hydraulic effect of belonging on engagement. So normally we think about, do I belong at school or do I not? This is how scholars have studied it primarily in the past. And this is how schools talk about belonging, right? But in terms of assessment, what we found is students' engagement was fluctuating throughout the day based on what class they found themselves in. Mm-hmm. But what we also found was belonging dictated to a large extent what their engagement levels were in those different classes. So in classes where engagement was higher, we found that students who were in those classrooms, or I would say the same student based on how we did it in the analysis, that same student, you know, their motivation or their engagement was higher in classes where they felt the sense of belonging and lower in classes where they did not feel the sense of belonging. And that fluctuated as they moved throughout the school day. Mm-hmm. What does this mean? It means that, you know, you can't just say that Billy is unmotivated to, you know, be in this class or be in this school, you know, and that reputation shouldn't follow Billy throughout the school. It's about the provision of opportunities that are provided by the educator inside of the space. But it also means the educators have power to set the instructional climate in the classroom such that students have a sense of belonging. And they can do that in a couple of ways. They can do that through meaningful feedback opportunities, right? What do I mean by that? It's not just giving students like detailed feedback and pushing students. It's also the affirm and the push, right? You know, hold them to high standards, but also have support and encouragement to say, I'm giving you this feedback because I believe that you can rise to the occasion, right? Right. You know, it's also the opportunity to just commune and to connect with other people. What does this look like? In an observational study that I did, we saw teachers say, here, I'm going to give you all one of each material, and then you're going to work together to solve this, you know, science problem, right? So you're forcing them to be able to work together and collaborate. And you even give instructions to them on, okay, if you have this and you have that, what does that mean for how y'all should be talking to each other, right? And then you see a student over here in the corner in a group that they are not engaging anymore. The teacher goes to the student and says, why aren't you participating? Well, I finished all my work already. It's like, how do you have all the answers, but none of your group meets are done? What's wrong with this picture, right? So the scaffolding around communalism also is a big part of this as well. Also, emotional availability of educators is important. And, you know, I think one of the last things is relevance, of course. So we all, you know, understand that relevance is important. But depending on what subject you're in, it can be hard for some teachers to make calculus relevant to students, right? You know, right. But, you know, importantly, if these are important, then schools should also provide the time for educators to make those connections and not, you know, force their hand and rush them in ways that, like, takes them away from their optimal, you know, impact.
Well, look, so, it sounds like you spend a lot of time in classrooms. How are teachers evaluated? How are they evaluated? Because, I mean, you know, even walking in the door, is there some sort of mechanism that you can scale or range people walking in the door that may help you figure out how well a teacher will be in the classroom? I mean,
I have a couple of beefs, you know, with the way teachers are evaluated. One way they're evaluated is based on their students' test scores. That's the biggest way, you know. Right. Are you moving students towards proficiency? How many students are proficient, et cetera? And the biggest shortcoming of that is that it doesn't really display all of the brilliance that the students possess. Mm-hmm. But the other reason why it's a shortcoming is because teachers who are actually affirming students and making them feel like they belong and have agency in society, you might expect to see different outcomes. Do you see students who are civically engaged, participating in programs that, you know, make community members come out and vote? Do you see students who are taking leadership positions in their schools and communities and signing up to do additional work, canvassing or SGA? You know, do you see people who are breaking barriers and achieving through STEM design competitions, oratorical contests? The list goes on. So, you know, the ways in which educators make students feel like they belong and subsequently, you know, engage them and make them feel like they can achieve and be anything they want to be, you know, that's not really all captured in the standardized tests. It's a very narrow metric, you know, right, that we know the odds are stacked, the deck is stacked against students there, but it also cuts those teachers off because they're not being evaluated on their real impact on students' lives. So I think we need to rethink the way we evaluate educators, particularly in terms of opportunities to belong in the classroom. We should have students' voices front and center and do it in a way that is more rapid, that gives teachers a chance to respond to the information that's placed in front of them, rather than what we do currently, which is assess, you know, teachers' effectiveness, quote unquote, by students' test scores at the end of the year. You know, how does that give a teacher a chance to really, like, you know, keep evaluating students and helping them achieve and reach their highest potential?
Yeah, I'm sort of in my numbers as well. and sort of how my mind thinks, and I'm seeing, like, you know, I'm looking for a correlation between, you know, a teacher's ability to help a young person belong, a young person's, you know, academic, the scale of a young person, you know, their academic achievement, you know, where they are, where they need to be. And then with the teacher evaluation, I'm looking for those three things to move in the same way. I mean, have you seen that, to where a teacher that makes kids belongs, the kids, you know, it's a direct correlation to their work, to the level of their work, you know?
I've seen it in terms of quality of work. You know, we had a project once where we supported STEM elective teachers in a number of curricular activities. But, you know, the activities weren't just motivating to the students, they were also motivating to the teachers. One of the teachers took the students aside and built a group of students who designed a school of the future and submitted it to a national design competition. In the first year of being in that competition, students won locally, regionally, and made it to the national level. They lost, but I got to ride with them and kind of really travel on their intellectual contributions. But we got to see the process, and I'm like, okay, you know, LeBron built the super team, you know, Golden State got a little super team. Why can't we have a super team and bring multiple schools together, you know, that are have like D&F report cards, bring them together and build a super team with students across these schools, you know? And so they messed around the next year and won the whole national competition. So the belonging experience looked way different on a quality level when educators had time to really invest and really take students on these experiences that help them understand that they have contributions to make to society. You know, but on a larger scale, you know, I've seen belonging connect to achievement in my research literature. There's a lot of scholarship that shows that, you know, belonging leads to students being able to better perform, not only on, you know, standardized tests, but also in terms of just GPA. So the link is there.
Have you looked at, you know, and I mean, I went to this huge PWI, right? Now, my feeling of belonging there, very different. I'm thinking, because I've never attended an HBCU, right? Have you looked at that? Like the belonging of me going to Virginia Tech, that feeling of belonging versus that feeling of belonging if I had gone to A&T.
I haven't compared. One reason why is because statistically, you know, how do we find Antoine Medley, you know, at Virginia Tech? It's so few of you, you know what I'm saying? That, you know what I'm saying? What are we going to do with those numbers? You know, it's going to be like five people.
Right.
So it's not that it can't be studied, but mostly, you know, the experiences of students at PWIs mostly are studied from a more qualitative, you know, standpoint based on their experiences and them telling their stories of what they've experienced in STEM disciplines and how they could be better. However, I do have a study right now that is at North Carolina Central University. We just finished the first phase, which is a qualitative phase where we asked the students one leading question in different interviews. If you could build your own STEM Wakanda here at this HBCU, what would it look like and what would it entail? What would be the supports around you and what would you be doing with your time? We're currently in the process of analyzing that data, and we're going to use it this year when we go, you know, back to design a measure that looks at all of the different dimensions, or as many of them as we can make fit, you know, that students mention, and then see the profiles of students who are high or low on certain dimensions and what that predicts in terms of their performance and GPA and all that kind of stuff, right? So we want the ideal, which is building the whole Wakanda. But in building up to that, if we know a couple of elements, you know, that are really effective, we can start there while we're building out the rest. So that's one of the current projects at the the undergrad level. At the high school, middle school level, I've been blessed to work with an amazing group of youth who have developed their very own belonging mixtape. It's, you know, a chance for them to serve as instructors, essentially, and share from their own perspective what belonging means to them, so you can hear directly from them. I think there's nothing wrong with me talking about belonging, but it's fresh when it's coming directly from young people, you know, right. Which connects to this idea of why Black and Belonging is such a pivot. So I wrote Black and Belonging started in 2016. It was published in 2018. It received the Outstanding Article Award or Best Article Award in my field in 2019 and started getting picked up by other foundations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and other organizations that use it as a guiding framework for conversations on belonging and even convenings that they've had. So I thought I had to write the next one. And I was telling my friend, like, look, I got to write the next one now. I can't be a one-hit wonder. And my friend was like, why? Most people haven't written anything that impactful in their entire lives.
Right.
Are there people who haven't heard the message yet? You know, right. Maybe you need to spread the gospel.
Evangelize.
So Black and Belonging, you know, stems out of my research. And it's a matter of spreading this message in a more practical way and collaborating with people so that we can embody it and not just skip over that part, you know, and moving from rhetoric to reality.
Right. Well, man, I mean, you're doing some great work. And I mean, and I see your work, you know, being something that will help young people, help our young people pivot, you know, into a more positive mind, right? Because I think that's what if we can affect our kids' minds, you know, force a pivot for them to think, you know, I do belong here, you know, this is a place for me, you know, then, you know, that'll make a kid go out here and do, you know, I can do anything.
So let me speak to that really quickly to say how we're strategizing on doing that. One of the biggest ways that we see is first showing that you heard them is our biggest strategy. So let's say we work with kids in a program 1 week. We might do it one day a week, right? People think dosage per week, you know, definitely matters and you're supposed to be consistent every day. But I need time to show that I really heard you. So let me step away, reflect on what you said. Next time when I see you, I show progress on what you said that you wanted or needed. You react to that, and then you keep brainstorming and building further from there, right? So that's the first key. The second thing that we do is we try to credential students. So whether it's something as simple as saying, okay, you won this competition, let me write you a thank you letter and tell you how much you contributed to your students' experiences and your peers' experience. And let's put that in your school file. You have nothing but negative or neutral things in your file. Why not add a letter from a community organization saying what you did that was positive, that was right, so that it can position you for the high school you want and ultimately the college that you want. And the third thing that we do is reposition young people as leaders in conversations. So can they be consultants? Can they be leading the conversation? I have a mentee right now. He is going to lead a professional development with his teachers at his high school in a couple of weeks. But we're also going to bring him to NC State to talk to professors and university administrators. And he's going to give opening remarks in a upcoming session on belonging that we'll have, where it'll be a roundtable about, you know, 15 different scholars talking about belonging intimately at a table from their perspective. But he's going to give the opening keynote to the high school student. If we don't walk away thinking that this student deserves a full bag to NC State, something is wrong.
Can the public come and can the public attend this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It'll be on September 22nd, which is a Thursday. Right now it's scheduled from noon to 1. We're just confirming, you know, some last minute logistics just to make sure that everything is kosher. But yeah, and it'll be in our College of Education's building. But folks can just reach out to me if they want to come through, and I'll be sure to give them the information and even try to figure out parking.
So how can people find more about Black Belonging maybe even reach out to you?
Yes, you can go to Heart Belonging. Heart Belonging is our social media handle. It's our social media handle on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. But, you know, we don't have a lot posted right now, but we have a whole lot of content that we built up that's coming. So there's going to be a tsunami of content that's coming this fall. So if you just go ahead and follow, you will experience some great things that young people are doing. Blackandbelonging.com is the website. You can check out not only the work that, we're doing with young people directly through our Heart Belonging mixtape, but also you can check out some of the blog entries that we have that showcase the brilliance of young people just doing great things even beyond the group that we work with. And as for me, you can reach out to me directly. Leon.gray@blackandbelonging.com is my email address. And also just connect with people over lunch. However we want to commune, I'm down for connecting with people with communal sensibilities and building a tribe forward. So just let me know.
Man, look, keep doing the work, man. I know you're newly married, you got a new little one, you know, keep laying out that path, man, for that little one, man. Cause I know, you know, we have our own motivations before we have children. And I'm pretty sure, you know, there's something in you that's changed a little bit now that you got that little one. You know what I'm saying? There's something there that might not have been there before. Right. So keep doing that work, brother. And I know the world will be a better place for it.
All right. Appreciate you, bro.
I'll reach out to you, man, because like I said, I'd love to come sit in on that.
It's intentionally built for community. You know, I think we're in a place now where this is the first year. Last year we were back on campus, but this year I feel like campus is really back. But right. It doesn't feel like it felt before, and people have even more of a need for social connection. So I need this event to not only talk about belonging, but I need people to feel it from the moment they walk in the door.
Right. Well, man, look, I'm not going to hold you anymore. I appreciate the conversation. You know, we'll stay in connection, and I hope some of the listeners reach out to you, man, because it's a powerful thing that you're doing. Very, very powerful thing.
Appreciate you.
All right, man. Thanks a bunch.
All
right. Later. Look, man, another great conversation. The brother's doing it. And one thing I really like is he's doing the work that he's doing, but he's doing it behind some numbers. It's facts. It's statistical. It's not, sometimes, we can get caught up in our hearts and things like that, which is good because, we need that. But this brother leads with his numbers and his facts. You can't argue with facts. You can't argue with numbers. You can argue with heart, but you can't argue with the other things. But, great conversation with DeLeon Gray. Look him up, blackandbelonging.com. Go visit that site. The site will blow you away. There's so much good stuff there. Go visit it and, listen to, read what's there. Reach out to him. I'm looking for anything that he's doing. I'm gonna try to get to it if I can. So, thanks for this. Thanks to him for coming on to talk to us. Thank you guys for listening. And couple of weeks. I'm looking to bring another good guest. But every week that we do a new show, they're gonna stack on top of each other. More and more great conversations. More and more information that people can use and just learn about how we pivot, because everybody's pivoting at some point, whether you're doing it now or whether you've done it somewhere in your life. So you guys have a good night. And again, please come back and check us out for another episode.
Thanks for joining us. Follow us on all podcast platforms and social media at The Forest Pivot. Go subscribe, share the show with everyone you know. We will be back soon with another awesome episode and guest. Remember, no life is lived in a straight line, and we must live, learn, and adapt.